Okay, and you are just before I get going, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if I could.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do I still have everyone?
Did somebody beep out?
No, this is Ben Street. I probably just beeped in.
I'm sorry. I didn't think he was joining the call. I told the clerk that you weren't joining, so I apologize for that.
That's okay.
Okay.
All right.
Now, I think we do.
I'm sorry, I didn't. This is Judge Petty. Who was that last person that joined us?
Street, Street, Benjamin Street.
And you are also representing the defendant?
Yes,
Emily?
Sir.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, Judge Huff.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. All right, I believe now we're ready, Mr. Jeffrey.
Yes, good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Donald Jeffrey from the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Commonwealth. This is a Commonwealth's pretrial appeals. I know the Court's aware. It is an issue you don't see very often on Commonwealth's appeal. It relates to statutory speedy trial violation. Defendant's motion to dismiss was granted below, and as the Court's no doubt familiar from the briefs, the March 2013 continuance is really the pivotal issue that brings us here today.
Mr. Jeffrey, this
yes,
is
sir.
Judge Huff, if I may ask a question. It strikes me that under the 1984 decision, the Godfrey case, the defendant had a right to remain silent, and that did not count as acquiescence in a speedy trial context. But then later in the Howard case, the decision went very much the other way, that silence in the face of an objection of a motion such as one made by the defendant or by the Commonwealth, silence would amount to acquiescence, and so the time would be told. Was there a change in the statute, 19.2.243, subparagraph 4, in the interim that resulted in that change in ruling?
Yes, sir. The change in the statute was in 1995, and it was an issue this court put its finger on, I think, first in the published Robinson case, and talked about the fact that there has been language worked into the statute which requires an affirmative objection. And the holding in Howard was also a sua sponte continuance, and essentially the holding there was that in the absence of an affirmative objection, that the time was told following that objection until such other further action occurred in the case. And that was really the crux of the change, and that was, I think, part of why Howard was decided the way it was. But the statutory change was in 1995, and there's a whole body of law that predates the statutory change that the defense has relied on in terms of the right to remain silent and stand mute and things of that nature, and that is, we believe, no longer the law. So that
Mr. Jefferson, this is Judge Petty.
Yes,
Howard, as I understand it, was a case in which the trial judge sua sponte continued the trial to a date certain. Is that correct? It was a short continuance, but to a date certain.
I think that is correct. Hold on just a minute. I've got Howard in front of me here.
Okay. Let me pose this to you kind of as a feeding off that. You'd agree with me, would you not, that as appellant it's your responsibility to provide us with a record to establish trial court error?
Oh, absolutely. Correct.
So as I read this record, and it's very, very sparse, we have a trial date scheduled for March 25th, 2013. We have no orders entered that I can see continuing that date. We have some discussion in the court, but there's nothing on the docket or docket book or any orders entered. Ostensibly, it was continued because the trial judge was ill. He, according to the argument of counsel, and he was back on the bench by May of 2013. And the next term of court would have been July 22nd, 2013. We have nothing to show why that case languished on the docket from, at minimum, the next term of court, next docket call, July 2013, till the date it was dismissed on August 15th, 2014. Doesn't that record pretty much preclude us from reversing this trial court?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and I'm relying, as the prosecutor did below, not just on Howard, but on the Jefferson case, which is a 23 Virginia appellate. Now, admittedly, that related to an indefinite continuance based on a defense activity, and actually it was pursuing some appellate remedies at an interlocutory stage that were ultimately the Supreme Court of Virginia said that was improper. But the holding in the case is essentially that once there's an indefinite continuance, that the defense then has to come in and announce ready before.
That's a continuance that's requested by the defense, and it makes sense that if the defense says, I need an indefinite continuance until something occurs, it's incumbent upon the defendant then to notify the court and the Commonwealth's attorney that whatever it was had occurred in cases that need to be set for trial. But this case, even if it was continued, even if the trial were canceled and it was continued, it wasn't continued indefinitely. There's nothing in the record to show this case was continued indefinitely. Is that a fair statement?
Other than that, it was continued to the trial. It was continued because the trial judge was ill, and I know counsel's got some concerns about certain representations that defense made below. But my understanding of it was that it was continued due to the trial judge's illness, and I have to say the only inference from the record is that it was continued indefinitely because
I spent a lot of time in trial courts. As a prosecutor, and when cases are continued, they are continued to the next docket call. They don't just disappear from the docket. They're either continued indefinitely or they're continued to the next docket call. And the next docket call would have been in July of 2013. This court meets every 3 months, I think it is, four times a year. But we don't have anything in the record to show what happened at that docket call.
There's nothing in the record showing what happened at docket call, and I would agree with you. I think that is a normal practice. That's just the record that we have here is that the judge got sick about 2 weeks prior to trial. The case was continued. There's no indication in the record that it was continued to any date certain. There was no objection to the continuance. And
do we know that? Is there anything in any order or docket memo that indicates there was no objection?
There's nothing written in the record that says that. What we are relying on, and I cited a couple of places, the record does not show any effort to ask that this be set for trial. There's no written pleading filed by the defense, nor does, and you know, as I suggested, and I think the Commonwealth suggested this below, could have filed, I guess for lack of a better term, a precipice or something written that would have been certified for service to opposing counsel that would have at least alerted both the court and the Commonwealth to the fact that they were prepared to proceed. You don't have that. You also have multiple representations, and I really only just cited a few of those in my brief that were indicated that there was nothing to object to because there was no written order. And
didn't we say in Adkins that the testimony of witnesses cannot stand in lieu of findings and rulings by the trial judge entered of record?
I'm not specifically familiar with Adkins, but that the language you cite is that goes back to Godfrey in the Supreme Court of Virginia, and that is the general rule. However, I would note that in Heron, I think I'm pronouncing it right, I may be butchering it, Heron Garcia, a fairly recent case of this court, where the defense challenged the nature of the nature of what had happened in the continuance. The court actually put a footnote in there and cited to the unilateral avowal cases, Whitaker, the Supreme Court case that the court cited to. What we think we have here, and obviously, Judge Petty, I can dance around this all day long. There's nothing written in the record. What we have to rely on is the body of law from this court that says that when there are concessions, what here is essentially tantamount to a stipulation, that those are binding on the appellee in this court, much as they were on the Commonwealth in the Logan case, and I cited you some other cases about stipulations. That's really what you have here. I mean, that is our record, and
it's your argument that once the trial date was canceled on March 25th, that there was no obligation on the part of the Commonwealth's attorney to set this case, even though from the next docket call until the date it was dismissed is well beyond the 5 months.
That's correct, and that would be based on the holdings both in Howard and in Jefferson, and it, admittedly, as you pointed out, Jefferson was a case of indefinite continuance based on defense activity and something the defense was trying to do. But I think that the holding carries over, and Howard, of course, stands for the proposition that in the post-1995 amendments to the statute that there has to be an express objection when there's a sua sponte continuance. And this case was continued. There's nothing in the record indicating this thing was continued to docket call. Then what essentially happened is a phone call was made, and you know, and there's been some effort to say that wasn't by someone official, but it's very clear from the record that everyone acted on that. And on page 61 of the joint appendix, the defense actually made a representation about it being an off-the-record sua sponte continuance. It's very clear that this case was continued based on the actions and the representations of the parties. And yes, that is our position. We've got no indication in this record that it was continued to docket call. And I understand what you're saying, that that's a fairly standard procedure, but there's just nothing here to say that anything happened other than that the judge got sick and the case was continued, and then nobody did anything. And to be honest, I hear what you're saying. I don't think that you're going to hold this out as a prime example of what the Commonwealth ought to do in terms of preserving its rights, but under the facts of this case and the existing law, without the objection, I do believe the trial court erred. And I'm sorry, I think I may have cut you off a minute ago.
No, I'm good, thanks.
You're at your 3 minute reservation point.
Yes, sir. Unless the court has further questions, I'll just reserve the remainder.
Mr. Gallenbeck?
Yes, sir. Before I start into what I had prepared, I'd like to say that, if it pleases the court, Jefferson and Howard are both irrelevant to this case. In both cases, there was a record of what the judge did. There was an order so that the court can actually review and see what happened. If you go to the Hernan Garcia case, which is very recent and is after Jefferson and Howard, that court used the same reasoning we're using on this appeal, that there was no record from which you can tell what happened in the lower court. And you can't rely
really
on...
This is Judge McCullough. Is there really a dispute as to what happened? I mean, basically, it seems pretty... I mean, it's one thing for if there's a conflict, right, with one witness having a different recollection from another witness, saying, no, that's not what happened. But here, I mean, the judge got sick. Someone from the court evidently contacted everybody, said this case is continued indefinitely. No order was entered. And then eventually the case was set for trial down the line. So, I mean, is there any dispute of fact about what really happened?
Yes, sir, and I don't believe it matters whether what we said or what was said on the record. Your court has, in the cases we've cited, which include Walker and include Powell, that you can only look to the record. For instance,
the record includes written motions and representations, not just orders.
Doesn't include... the judge nor the Commonwealth's attorney concurred in anything that was said during argument. And what is said during argument is not evidence of what should be in the record. For instance, Judge, let's assume that the secretary or someone did call my office and spoke to my secretary and said that the trial's off for tomorrow or 2 days from now. What if we objected to that? What if we told her or him that we objected to the continuance? And first of all, we don't believe it is a continuance. If we objected...
Does the current state of the law require you to affirmatively make an objection to, for instance, send a letter to the judge or file some... some type of motion asking the case be docketed for trial?
It only requires that we object to the orders and proceedings. And, Judge, there wasn't even a proceeding here. Y'all had a case of Blevins versus Commonwealth. I don't know if you remember that or not. It's an unpublished case. In that case, defense attorney and the Commonwealth agreed to a continuance. They did not appear in court. Both signed an order, and both then forgot to submit it to the judge. It came time for trial. Defense attorney moved for speedy trial violation. The judge entered the order nunc pro tunc. The Court of Appeals said that was based on a fiction because the parties had never appeared in court. The Court of Appeals said that the judge could not enter an order nunc pro tunc because it was based on a fiction. Here there was no proceeding. In Blevins, he won the speedy trial motion. As a result, there was no proceeding in this case.
Right, there's 19.2-243-4 talk about a continuance granted, and then it says, by failure of the accused or his counsel to make a timely objection to such a motion by the Commonwealth, by the attorney for the Commonwealth.
It's such a motion, it's not an order.
But there was no continuance in this case. Just like in the Blevins case, there was no proceeding. There has to have been a proceeding. And the court doesn't know, based on the record in this case, whether we objected when a telephone call was made. From this record, which is what
we
know,
that telephone call, or at least we can fairly deduce that telephone call was made, and there's no trace by way of letter, motion, anything that would note any kind of objection to what the court did.
Judge, if I were at the Piggly Wiggly 2 days before trial and the judge's secretary walked up to me and said, your case is off for 2 days from now, and I said, well, I object to that, none of that is part of the record. The court here has to assume that we did not make an objection, and that, I mean, the fact, you can no more assume that we did not make an objection than you can assume that the case was actually continued.
What happened after this case was continued? The term of court in Buchanan County, criminal term begins the fourth Monday, January, April, July, and October. Now, that case should have appeared on the docket at the July criminal term of court. What happened to it?
Nothing.
I mean, there is nothing
in the record to indicate that anything happened until March of the next year. And again, we object to the use of the term continuance. By looking at the record, to which we believe the court is confined, all the court knows is that the trial did not occur on the day it was scheduled.
Let me ask you one other question. In the transcript, and I'm looking around pages 86 and 87 of the appendix, the trial judge refers to the minute book of the clerk.
Yes.
Did the minute book of the clerk ever make it into the record in this case?
I know it did. I don't know whether it made it to y'all. I can tell you this. There were no entries on the day of the purported trial. There were no entries.
It's not in the appendix, so I can't see what's in it or not in it.
Right.
But it looks like the trial court may have, in making its decision, referred to that. If it's not in the record and we don't know what's in that, can we say that the trial court was mistaken? Erred?
Yes, sir. If we look at the Duran case, Juan Garcia. In that case, the court made clear that it was up to the Commonwealth to complete the record. I can tell you, and I know you're not taking evidence at this stage, I can tell you there were no entries in the minute book.
Well, I'd prefer the record demonstrate that.
And we would prefer that the record demonstrate why this this case never went to trial. And also, Judge, we don't think that you can look at what purported admissions we made at trial. First of all, it was not raised in the lower court. Second of all, and there could have been a motion for rehearing scheduled. In addition, it was not raised in the petition for appeal. Since it was not raised, and it's set out as a second argument, since it was not raised in the petition for appeal, that particular question is not before this court in this appeal. And based on Rule 5A12C1i, you may not even consider that because it was not raised in the petition for appeal. So, I mean, even if you otherwise could, you have no jurisdiction to consider that argument. And there's no, under Rule 5A12C11, there is no ends of justice exception.
So your argument is that the assignment of error is limited to whether Howard v. Commonwealth applies to these facts.
Yes, sir. I mean, I think they are barred jurisdictionally by 5A12C11. If I could just take a second to see what I haven't said that was in my argument. The court is familiar with all the cases, but all the cases clearly say that in a court of record, there has to be an order, particularly in, If you look at the Walker case, and that's a Supreme Court case, 225 Virginia 5, in talking about speedy trial, the court says the records spoken of in Section 8 of the Constitution is that which distinguishes a court of record from one not of record. It is the order book in which the code sections citing them are required to be kept, and the proceedings, orders, and judgments of the court of record. A court speaks only through its orders. And then it goes on to say that you can't rely on the statements of the litigants. We also, after the brief submitted by the rebuttal brief submitted by the other side, we would ask the court to look at, if I can find it here, it's supposed to be right in front of me, look at, Judge, if you could give me just one second, for some reason my cases have gotten a little out of place here. I'm sorry, here it is. Look at Austin versus Consolidated Coal Company, 256 Virginia, 78. That's a 1998 case at page 81. And in that case, the court made an oral order. And then there was a written order that followed. In its oral order, it specified and directed the parties to do a certain thing. The Supreme Court found that because that was not in the written order, it was not part of the record, and that the court speaks only through its written orders. And we believe that the only real question here is what is shown in the record. And what is shown in the record is only that the trial didn't occur, not that there was a continuance, and that it was more than twice the speedy trial limit when the next motion was filed by the Commonwealth. There has to be some sort of proceeding. The court here, if finding there was a proceeding, that would be fictitious and would be similar to the entry of an order nunc pro tunc, which this court in the unpublished case of Blevins versus Commonwealth says is improper. And that the Blevins case was after the change to the statute. Thank you.
Mr. Gallenbeck, this is Judge Huff. So you're suggesting that since there was no order or nothing reflected in the minute book, then you get a free pass. You don't have to object, notwithstanding what the statute requires, and so that can't be held as acquiescence. I mean, you've conceded, or it's pretty clear that the trial did not occur on the date when it was scheduled, and there was no objection to that, but you're suggesting that's not acquiescence because there's no order.
I'm suggesting really three things. Number one, that there is no record of a continuance, so there was no continuance. It just didn't happen. Number two, because there is no record, your court does not know whether we did in fact object when the secretary called. We don't even know if she was authorized to do so. But when the secretary or clerk called, that your court does not know whether we stated our objection at that point. So you'd be giving the benefit to the Commonwealth of there being no record, and then saying to us, well, it's not in the record that you didn't object, that you did object. I think the court has to take one position or the other. And the court has to come up with a conclusion that there was no continuance, and at the very least, there is no record to base whether the defendant objected or not.
Very well. If there's nothing further, you're right at the end of your allotted time.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Jeffrey, your remaining 3 minutes.
Your Honor, very briefly, among the other representations that I mentioned in the brief, I noted page 85 to 86 of the joint appendix that there was a representation by defense counsel that Ms. Keene was entitled to sit on her hands, and I'm paraphrasing, and that it's up to the Commonwealth to move the case to trial. Multiple oral representations, there's nothing written indicating an objection anywhere in the record. No objection.
To some extent, isn't that a correct statement of the law? I mean, in Flannery, the Supreme Court said it is the duty of officers charged with the responsibility of enforcing criminal laws to prepare for and obtain a trial of an accused within, at that time, 3 regular terms of court.
Yeah, it is. Obviously, the Commonwealth has some duty to move. The only question here is what the effect of the change to 243 in 1995 did. And again, there's no objection in this record, and the defense is steadfastly by his oral, her oral representations indicated that they never objected.
Mr. Jeffrey, before time's up, I want to ask you that one question about the clerk's minute book. Is there anything in our record that is from the clerk's minute book that the court referred to?
Is this Judge Petty?
Yes, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Judge Petty. I wasn't certain. I will say this, because I think I have to say this in fairness to Ms. Keene's counsel. There was some discussion about trying to get some things up from the trial court, and I certainly represented to them that if you look on page 86, Mr. Gallenbeck did make a representation when the court was inquiring about it that he had not looked at the minute book, but that it was his understanding that no entries had been made. I will tell you that in purposes of preparing this appeal, and certainly if I didn't say it expressly, I certainly strongly implied that I believe that given the standard of review, that for purposes of this appeal, based on Mr. Gallenbeck's representation that was never contradicted, that probably we're stuck with no entries being in the minute book. I mean,
what if the clerk minute book did have an entry in it that says defendant's objection noted? I mean, and the court apparently referred to it, the trial court, and we don't know whether what's in that, how can we just assume that it didn't have some relevant information?
I'm looking at the comments.
It doesn't appear that anybody had looked at it at the time of the hearing. They're all talking about what if, but it appears that there's some part of a record of some of the court or of the clerk's office that, at least I don't have in the appendix.
No, and it's not part of the record. I'll grant you that, and Mr. Gallenbeck certainly said it was his understanding that no entries were made. My inference from that, I don't know, just kind of knowing how I conduct myself, is that he probably at least consulted with the clerk but hadn't actually physically looked at it, so he wasn't comfortable saying, essentially, I've looked at it myself and there's nothing there. But I was looking for the I think the trial court certainly strongly implied that it might intend to look at the minute book. I don't know that it's really on the record that he ever did, but I may just be missing something more affirmative, but that's my understanding, is that there was a representation that there were no entries made in the book, and that was a fact binding at this point.
The last thing I wanted to ask you to address is the argument about the scope of the assignment of error.
Your Honor, I looked at the assignment of error while he was talking. I suggest to you it talks about Howard. It talks about speedy trial. And the court has certainly, and I'm thinking about cases recently like Finley, there's been some evolution as to how specific I think that the assignment has to be. I just would suggest to you here that aside from the fact that he cited the case, the assignment did encompass a speedy trial argument. This court has never said, certainly in the 5A18 context, and I cited you a treasure trove of cases, that you can't rely on case law and things of that nature that weren't cited in the assignment of error itself. So I that's my response to that. I think that the 5A12 question is answered by Finley and similar cases from the Supreme Court of Virginia, that this does adequately alert the opposing party as to what the issue is going to be on appeal, and with respect to the 5A18 argument again, and I cited you probably about a half a dozen cases that talked in terms of the judge having an opportunity to rule intelligently here. The facts, again, were largely undisputed. The Commonwealth's attorney made the correct legal arguments in terms of both citing case law and the legal principles, so I think the purposes of 5A18 were satisfied. And I've probably run out of time. I had a couple more things to say. But
you have, sir. I was waiting for you to finish the response to Judge Petty's question. But you have exhausted your time. We thank you both for your well-done arguments, and be hearing from us shortly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Judge.
Bye-bye.